Get ready. Get comfy for the next Nonprofit Insider Podcast episode.
All right. Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Nonprofit Insider Podcast. I am your host, Swim Cream. Welcome in. Listen, I'm not even wasting any time today. I've been talking about this the last few weeks. I said, listen, I've got a guest. I can't really share a lot. I want to kind of keep it a surprise. The guest is in the building. I'm going to introduce her here in a little bit. Jenny, good morning to you.
Good morning.
I'm going to introduce you here in a little bit. Be sure to follow us on Instagram and TikTok. Everyone's doing it. You know, you got to do the TikTok thing. So follow us on Instagram, follow us on TikTok. We've always got videos dropping right there. You can find us, the Nonprofit Insider Podcast, there. And that would be really nice. And be sure to listen to our previous episode. I talked a little bit about donor advised funds and what that really looks like for the nonprofit space. One of the big things we know, Jenny, you're a fundraiser, fundraising. What are some of the different avenues that nonprofits can gain money, get money, and keep it and use it to their advantage? So I talk a little bit about donor funds, share some nonprofit horror stories, and then some different insights on scams in the nonprofit space so you don't get scammed. So go back, listen to episode 44 and take a peek at that. Okay. I've got my checks and my balances here. I've got my notepads here. I've got a lot of things here, but the most important thing is the person. We have Jenny Mitchell here on the show. Jenny Mitchell is the Chief Visionary Officer of Chavender. That's Chavender like lavender, where she works closely with not-for-profit leaders to change the world one mission at a time. She is a dynamic speaker, executive coach, professional fundraiser, a family person, host of the Underdog Leadership Podcast. You really are like a little bit of everything, Jenny. How are you?
I'm doing great. And it's so funny to have yourself introduced, right? It's like this weird mirror moment when people reflect back and you're like, wow, yeah, I really do a lot, don't I, Swim?
Yeah, it's like you had to pat yourself on the back.
You know? I know. And sometimes, you know, it seems appropriate for not-for-profit. We're so busy running that we haven't checked the map in a while, or, you know, we're so busy doing that we don't get a chance to reflect. So thank you for that, actually taking a moment just to kind of take stock. And I'm hoping to have a great conversation with you, and I'm hoping I can bring some value to your membership.
Listen, we have nothing but time and runway. And that's one of the beautiful things about podcasts, right? You have the ability to sit down. You know, you've got a podcast, many, many episodes. Be sure to check that out, y'all. Underdog Leadership. We're going to put all that in the show notes, all of that stuff. But one of the big things, Jenny, you have a book.
Yeah.
That recently came out. And it came out on a very special day. Women's International Day, if I'm not mistaken, right? March 8th.
Yeah. And also happens to be my birthday.
No, stop playing. Really?
Yep. I was born on March 8th, 19. And it was actually not International Women's Day when... That gives you an idea of how old I am or how young I am. But I always tell people it was my birthday first, and then they decided to make it International Women's Day. Woo!
This is crazy because I didn't know you were Pisces, because yep. I'm not even joking right now. My birthday is the day before yours.
You're kidding. March 7th?
19.
Yeah.
March 7th. That's my birthday. Don't no one go on and scam me and take my identity. But yeah, it's March 7th. So that's super funny. On your birthday?
Yep, on my birthday. Yeah, very cool.
Embracing ambition, empowering women to step out, be seen, and lead. You have a great collection of stories in here. I want to get to the question of who is Jenny Mitchell, but I want to start with a little quote from your book, if that's okay.
Okay, please.
Page 176. I got it highlighted and everything like that. I want to read a quote because I think this is a really good springboard to the rest of the conversation. You said, and I quote, "Today, I no longer extend copious amounts of energy trying to get things right or trying to lead in a certain way. I am keenly aware of my strengths and limitations, and I focus on my energy on uplifting, empowering the people around me. While I still prepare for important meetings, I know it is more important to be present than to be right. And I trust that as long as I come in with an open heart and good intentions, I have the confidence in my ability to address any challenges that may come up. When keeping that quote in mind, who is Jenny Mitchell? And what was the journey you traveled that prompted you to add such a powerful line in your book?
So let me back up to the playground, because I think we have a lot of formative experiences in the playground swim. And my story in the playground was that I knew what it felt like to be excluded. I knew what it felt like to not be invited to play hopscotch or to not jump on the jungle gym or whatever it was. And as soon as I learned the behaviors that got me into play hopscotch and jump on the jungle play yard, I made it my mission in life to include people so that there didn't have to be people on the sidelines that weren't part of the experience. And that, to be honest, as I think about this, that has really shaped very much of what I have done. And I think that's why the podcast is called Underdog Leadership. I think that's why I ended up in the not-for-profit sector. I think that's why I hold ambition and compassion as two equally important criteria for leaders, because the world needs more humanity. We don't need more money, ego. Let's not go politics here. You know, we need people that care about people, and that's what keeps me coming back.
Sorry, that young? You can really trace it all.
I can. Oh, yeah. Oh, I totally can.
Were you one of those people that knew at a very early age what direction you were going?
Well, I think, well, that's a funny story, right? Because I spent 30 years as a classical musician. I was in school till I was 30. My background is classical music. So talk about very self-absorbed. It was a wonderful, wonderful career. And I loved it. And I met some incredible people, Swim. I think when you think about not-for-profit, you know, music, the arts has that same kind of experience, right? It's you don't go in it to make money. You go in it for the connections. And some of those people are still my very, very dearest friends to this day. But I also always knew I had there was a niggling there or like a incompleteness. I was far too much of a people person to sit in a room and practice piano 4 hours by myself.
Okay.
It wasn't going to happen. And I was always the person that was organizing things at school or coordinating things or bringing people together. And really, when I had my first fundraising experience, it was raising money for pianos at the conservatory where I was working in New York City. And the irony was I fell into this whole committee thing and just loved it. I loved the fact that we could build something that was bigger than ourselves. Total high, by the way, Like I just felt like I was on cloud nine learning and growing with these people, and we raised some money and we were able to make the world better. And I don't take that lightly. You know, sometimes we get lost in the not-for-profit world with all the BS and the politics and the weird grants and the rules and the regulations and the way this people from outside the sector see us. But you know, at the root of it, you keep coming back because you have these amazing conversations with people that care about others.
Yes, yes. And I know we're going to talk a lot more about your journey. It is interesting that you mentioned the arts. A lot of people definitely have that connection of the arts and the not-for-profit space. I oftentimes say in the podcast, one of the big aspects of the nonprofit space is there's a lot of money that flows and funnels, obviously, to all types of organizations. But I always consider the big three to be arts, medicine, and education.
Yeah.
Over the last 100, 200 years, really since the last big gilded age, you know, we're in one right now, Silicon Valley, big tech. Yeah. But when you think of the Carnegies and the Rockefellers, those types of names, and even going even further back, right? The aspect of funding arts and education and medicine, it continues to this day. And you're now part of that legacy in so many ways.
Yeah. And I think each sector has a different flavor, right? So I think of healthcare and I think of higher education as very sophisticated sectors on the whole. I'm simplifying, right? They have machines behind them. They have structures. They have best practices. The arts, somewhat, you know, I think social services is sort of the next layer down, we're seeing more money mm-hmm. getting funneled into environmental causes now, which has never really been before. Mm-hmm. We're also acknowledging here in Canada, at least we're talking a lot about Indigenous causes. I know the States, you guys are talking about racialized communities and the fact that they get such a small piece of the pie. I don't know exactly the numbers, so I'm not going to quote them, but it's a percent of a percent that's being funneled into those kinds of charities just because people give to things that people of means give to things that are familiar to them. The sector has a lot more diversity than you realize when you first start out. It's also a huge part of GDP. Like in Canada, we are something like 19% of GDP. And people don't realize that. It's a booming sector, rife with beautiful things and really messed up things.
One more time, I have the book here. Embracing Ambition, Empowering Women to Step Out, Be Seen, and Lead. I want you to describe this, but what can people look forward to when they add this book to their collection? I'm going to put it right here so people can see it nonstop.
Love it. So the book comes out of a deep desire I talked about that playground area, right? The playground experience. I believe that that women have more to contribute than they're currently contributing. And there's a lot of reasons that women can get passed over or miss opportunities. Some of those are societal, for sure, and structural, for sure. And, you know, women make different choices than men along the way, vis-a-vis lots of pieces. But I felt we weren't doing a good job of, I don't want to use the word educating, we weren't doing a good job of helping those future leaders understand what they were going to be up against. And so when they hit those things, it was like this shocker. And I was like, listen, this has been going on for forever. We can do a better job of preparing you for this. And so when I was putting the book together, I thought, first I wanted research. I can tell you my personal experience as SWIM, but I wanted it to be rooted in research. So from the research from Dr. Megan Rabine, who is the dean at Douglas College, which is the college at Rutgers, focusing on, it's a women's college. She brought forward 5 barriers, or we like to call them pillars, of the experiences of women aspiring to leadership. We can talk more about the details of them, but by and large from the research, you may not hit all 5, but you're sure as heck going to hit 3 or 4 of them. And so the book is about what they are. And then what I love about the book is it's all storytelling. There are 12 women CEOs that tell their personal leadership stories and how that barrier related to their world. And just to be clear, these aren't just like, I was born in 1972 and da-da-da-da-da. It's more like this moment in time, this is how I handled it. Because I wanted people to read it and say, oh, that's how it feels to lead. That's how it feels to be a leader.
Absolutely. And it's super funny. I definitely, I marked, got it right here already. You can tell page 35, she has a nice rundown, started stalking her on online because she's got some great stuff in here. And you've quoted her on a couple of different, venues. So just an amazing marriage in that respect.
Oh, yeah. A real, real marriage, meeting of the minds. You know, when you work with academics, you never know quite how it's going to go, in the sense that some of them are very proprietary. Some of them are very, you know, but Megan Rabine, interesting story. She came up through the ranks as a professional fundraiser and moved through academia that way. Was VP of strategy, VP of fund development, all that stuff. And now finds herself as a dean empowering the people around her to make stuff happen. So it was a real meeting of the minds. We talked at length about, what we wanted to make sure was included. It was important to us that there were multiple voices, not just white women. And we have a collection from North America. So it was important to have Americans and Canadians, people of different colors, different backgrounds. And I have to say, ironically, that was my intention, and I definitely accomplished that. But SWIM, the stories are more similar than different, believe it or not. The themes are more similar than different. And we arrived together in Toronto to write this book. So we took a weekend. We arrived on the Friday night, 12 of us, 12 women. And, you know, I knew most of them, but I didn't know all of them very well. They didn't know each other at all. It could have been a total flop. right? Terrible flaw.
It's a lot of personalities coming together.
Yeah, totally. And what I was really amazed at was how quickly, like, they understood that each of them got each other. You know, when you're in a room of peers, the only funny joke we had on the Saturday morning was I kept saying, okay, ladies, I'm in charge. Because you're talking about a whole bunch of type A women, right? So I kept saying, hey, I'm in charge. You're following my process. And we had a wonderful weekend and we left with kernels of a story, which took some time to suss out. I had a wonderful editor, credit to Michelle Fischering at Champlebleu for getting us through that process.
Writing a book, we got to talk some more about this book, but writing a book is probably one of the things that is universal for a lot of people. A lot of people want to be able to write a book, whether it's a novel, a short story, kids' books. How was the process for you, not only writing your portion of the book, but gathering those books? Like, what was your headspace like from the time you had the idea? Maybe you had that in grade school too, to the time you published the book on your birthday. What was that process like?
Daunting, if I'm perfectly honest, like, you know, stick to itness. So initially was like, I'm an academic, right? I have a doctorate in piano performance. I believe in learning. I love learning. It's like one of my vices. I'm constantly trying to learn and I'm constantly interested in things, which has a plus and a minus, right? Because I end up burning myself out. But I knew I wanted that milestone of a book felt really like an arrival point. But when I thought about writing it myself, I was like, it was a bit like the piano practice room again. I was like, wow, do I really want to spend that much time by myself analyzing myself? The minute I thought about doing it in collaboration with women and other people, it sparked just so many more opportunities for me. So I knew that was the path. I was able to trust my gut on that. And once I trusted my gut on that, and once I stepped into it, two thoughts emerged. One, this is going to be amazing. And two, I don't know how to do this. Like, I really didn't know how to do this. So I had to kind of lean into a bit of discomfort and frame out a way that I could make this work. You got 12 women, 12 opinions, 12 styles of writing. Just because you're a CEO doesn't mean you can write or storytell. So, I mean, again, I leaned on the editor in that framework and we finished May. So March, we were in together in a beautiful hotel room working through this. May was the deadline for the first draft of the stories. We spent the full summer last summer editing, revising, going back and forth in collaboration with the women. Very typical for women, actually, to work in collaboration, right? We tend to feed off each other. That's a theme of the book, Swim, is we're just kind of wired that way. And it was, we kind of brought each other along in the process. I think that was very joyful. And then, you know, the book got submitted to the publisher November of last year. So all in, it actually took a year, which is kind of mind-boggling because I certainly know of lots of more books that took more than that.
See, it's funny because I have a set of questions, but now I have so many more questions. We're talking burnout, collaboration, we're talking all of those things. And I think we're going to have some time to get into a lot of these different aspects as we continue here. You know, one of the things in the book, you talk about ambition and compassion being able to coexist in leadership, hence the name of the book. Why do you think the marriage between compassion and ambition is so difficult for leaders to even do?
Yeah. We don't have a lot of role models for it. We have a lot of top-down, authoritarian. I mean, it's changing. The pandemic has really blown that up too, right? But, you know, you think of what your profile of a president or in my country, the prime minister looks like. It's mm-hmm. pretty boxy, right? It's pretty authoritarian. It's when you bring in the word collaboration, it's seen as a weakness. When you bring in the idea of listening more than talking more, it's seen as you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, let's call a spade a spade. I also want to talk about the patriarchy aspect to leadership. So I don't think they did it on purpose, but because they went first, because typically men were the first ones to lead, mm-hmm. it makes women other than, or secondary or a different than the traditional style. And maybe rather than thinking of it as less than, we just think of it as different. And so in the spirit of inclusion and diversity, being open to different styles of leadership is something I'm very hopeful for the next 20 years in both countries, right? And just to finish, women's energy is, and I'm stereotyping here and I'm generalizing swim, and all people have masculine and feminine energy, just to be clear. There's times when I need to get stuff done. There's times when I'm very direct. I'm not saying I skirt a tough conversation, but also feminine energy, you know, as a fundraiser, I'm always thinking about how to beguile, how to bring people in, listening, trying to connect in a meaningful way. Imagine if you could have all those skills in one. And so I believe that to be ambitious, you actually must have as a criteria compassion, because if you don't have compassion for yourself and compassion for the people you work with, you actually can't hold them accountable. Because if you don't care about them, they will never respect you and they will never hold themselves accountable because they don't respect you.
Listen, what you're saying cannot be denied. That's just a fact. And it's funny because you and I, we started connecting, started reaching out to one another. I was like, I got to get you here on the show. And then a couple of things that we all know, but continues to just be reaffirmed. And one of the things that came, one of the things that I have come to despise about being in the nonprofit space, how when you look at not-for-profit organizations, you see women all over organizations. Yes. I mean, leading,
that's right,
powering, advising, consulting. But as you tend to get higher and higher up the ladder, you see fewer and fewer women. And just last month in the Harvard Business Review, there was an article by Kathleen Kirkland titled, "More Women Work in Nonprofits. So Why Do Men End Up Leading Them?" This is often a worldwide trend, but you're based in Canada.
I am.
When looking at Canada as a whole, to what degree have you observed seeing fewer and fewer women in positions of leadership? And what can we as a society do to ensure that women are at the head of the table, regardless if the not-for-profit organization is big or small?
Yeah. So the facts, 80% of the not-for-profit sector is, in Canada at least, is women. And yet less than 10% of CEOs are women.
Wait a minute. So, excuse me, what?
Exactly. 80% of the workforce.
That's
in
almost worse than what we have in the U.S. Yeah. Percentage-wise.
Less than 10% are women at the helm. And I'm talking not-for-profit. The trends kind of translate into for-profit, more or less. Not quite as extreme, but so your question is kind of, why does it happen and how can we change that dialogue or that paradigm? So I think the first step, I'm thinking about your community and your listeners, there are already, as I talk to them right now, amazing leaders out there that have all the skills and the abilities to make it to the C-suite. A lot of things are going to happen in their lives in the next 15 years that change the trajectory of things. Mm-hmm. On a simple level, accepting the fact that you are ambitious, not everybody is, and that's totally fine. Like, some people live to work, some people work to live. Totally get it. But knowing which one you are and which one fuels you is really important. The second thing is starting to talk about your ambitions with people that you trust and respect so that you can have some allies within the organization so that they know. I think often women are very afraid to ask for what they need or what they desire. The phrase, don't get too big for your britches. You know, we know that when women apply for jobs, and this is in the research, if there are 10 qualification points, you know, if they only apply if they have 8 or 9. And typically men will say, well, I'll throw my hat in the ring if I have 5 or 6 of those, and I'll figure it out as I go along. Mm-hmm. So really kind of getting out of their comfort zones, not easy. And also, I think women in particular really struggle with perfectionism, not that men don't, but this idea that it has to be perfect or you're an utter failure. And so in societal terms, I'm going to kind of blow this up a minute. If you look at the biology, okay, in the olden days, in the Neanderthal world, the male archetype would go and provide. And for the women, their role was taking care of food, family, and et cetera. And they worked very collaboratively to do so, right? It takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
And that was a natural progression. But for a woman to be ostracized, to be removed from that community meant death. You didn't have access to food. You didn't have access for your children, right? So yeah. I just want to like articulate that there are at the biological level some fundamental fears that must be addressed, and I don't want to say overcome, but maybe embraced is a better word, to be able to be comfortable. Look, we know for a fact that politicians that are women are attacked publicly on social media. I mean, they put a heck of a lot on the line when they put their hand up. And I think until we recognize that sacrifice, we will not change those percentages.
Yeah, the politicians is a good example of what you're kind of indicating. Yeah, the attacks and the fury that can come if a lot of our women that are in positions of leader in the political space can be so much more vicious.
Very much.
With their male counterparts, yeah. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
I want to come back a little bit here to the book here in a little bit, but a large part of your background is in the not-for-profit space. I know you said you kind of started on that elementary school playground, really identifying, looking in the mirror of who you are and mm-hmm. what you were, almost like a vision of what you were to become. But I know a lot of people who are in the nonprofit space who say they ended up in it accidentally. Classical pianist. You got that background in music. How did you even end up in the nonprofit world to begin with?
Yeah. You know, and thank goodness I did, but it was very haphazard, right? It was access to, so let's use this as a modeling journey for your listeners, right? So if you're listening and you're trying to figure out where you want to go next, let's unpack the journey. So part A was I graduated, 30 years old out of school, and I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do with this music degree, right? So I knew I could write swim because I had a doctorate. So I was like, okay, I literally went, okay, I like this fundraising thing. I hear there's this thing called grants. Maybe I could work as a grant writer. This was my thought process. So transfer your skills. That's part one.
Yes.
Find some skills to transfer. Part two, volunteer. I volunteered on my skills and I sat on a committee. That's number two. Number three for me was I had a baby. And that changes a lot of priorities for you, right? And that was a really big wake-up call because I was like, okay, my partner has a job at a bank, regular hours, and I am working as a musician evenings and weekends. This is not sustainable. Like, we're never going to see each other. So what else can I do? And that is the question I'd love to have your listeners think about is, how can I transfer the skills I already have into something future? And so I went, when I came home, I moved back to Canada when the kids were little, I went to a conference, an Association of Fundraising Professionals conference here in Ottawa, and I had a specific goal. So number three is pick a goal, be specific. I wanted to meet mm-hmm. all the consultants in Ottawa because I figured somebody had work that we could break off and I could learn from them. So I was looking for a mentor, really, is what I was looking for. And so I worked for this wonderful mentor of mine for over 5 years when my family was small. I wrote grants. I did funding requests. I did stewardship. I did annual reports. I got my hand and learned the craft with an amazing woman who taught me a lot. So that's how I ended up in not-for-profit. And I would have continued that, but then she had some changes in her life and that business was no longer. And I was like, oh, I guess I have to get a website. Like, it was kind of like that. And that was the fourth one is invest. I think it was more believe in yourself, believe that you can do it and you'll figure it out. I mean, swim, I'm sure your path is just as varied as mine is, but you didn't set out at 18 to be a podcaster, I'm going to guess.
No. No, right? I did not.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yeah, no, yeah, I did. I definitely did not. But yeah. But as with every passing day, you get a collection of new information, new experiences. Like you're saying, on that journey, and then you're discovering, and you start to believe in yourself, and you go, yeah, I could do it. be a podcast, I could be an engineer, whatever it is for individual people, you kind of pick it up.
You know, my saddest thing is when I talk to people. So I work now as an executive coach. So I help women leaders move from number two to number one. And the saddest thing I hear when I talk to people is, well, I'm not really happy, but I'm not really sure why. And I'd like to be doing something different, but everybody kind of sees me this way. That sort of not taking responsibility for your own choices and actions, it makes me really sad, because all of us have the ability to make changes. I'm not saying it isn't hard. I'm not saying it won't cause sleepless nights. And especially when I acknowledge that sometimes it has ramifications for your bank account. But do you really want to? Another thing I say often is, what's the opportunity cost of doing nothing? I don't think we calculate enough the cost of being stuck or staying in the place we're at. There's a cost to you on that. So just be aware of it. If you choose it, that's fine. But I'm always sad when I hear people that are settling when they could do more.
Listen, I want to take a quick break. We're going to come back here in a second. We've got the book. We're going to bring that back here in a second. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back with some more questions. But first, let me tell you about my friends at artoftea.com. You've heard of artoftea.com. I've been talking about them for some time here on the podcast because, look, you like a good cup of tea. I know for me, after my son was born, there was about a solid 4 or 5 years where I was drinking coffee every day, and it was good. It was nice at the time. But deep down, I was always a tea fan even before he came into this world. And one of the things is, I was like, you know, I want a little bit of caffeine, or I want, you know, something a little bit light in the morning or anything like that. And that's where artoftea.com comes in. And they have this really cool thing called the Tea Club. Sounds really fancy, right? Where they'll send you teas directly in the mail. They have 3 month subscription, 6 month subscription, even 12 month subscription. And here's the thing. I like a good herbal tea, like a good green tea, a good caffeine free tea, but black teas aren't really my thing. I can get this 6 month subscription, and for a lot of those black teas, I actually don't tell anyone, but I multi-purpose them. And so I turn them around and I'll re-gift them. And then I kind of bundle them up. And for the people in my life that I know like black teas, they are a great opportunity for me to use them for birthdays, surprises, anniversaries, or just little gifts that I can send in the mail to folks. Be sure to go to artoftea.com. I've got 10% off for you in the show notes. So go to the show notes, check them out. We appreciate our friends at artoftea.com. All right, everyone. Listen, we are back. Swim Kareem, host of the Nonprofit Insider Podcast. I'm back with Jenny Mitchell. Look at that book. I love the cover. Was it hard finding that cover? Embracing Ambition, Empowering Women to Step Out, Be Seen, and Lead. How was it coming up with the cover?
That's a great question. So I have to credit the publisher for this one. Yeah, it looks good, doesn't
great.
It?
Great. I love the colors.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, kind of matches a little bit. I'm like, kind of.
You look great, Swim. You look fab. Yeah, the black really, really pops. So when I spoke to the publisher was in charge of the cover, and I gave him full carte blanche because, you know, we're in partnership together. But we had good discussions about. I was like, it can't be pink. Okay, it cannot be pink. We don't want
to. Listen, I appreciate that, and yeah. I'm not a woman, but I appreciate.
Yeah, like. It can't be pink. And it's got to have a font that is solid, but still feminine, right? And we worked a lot on that woman on the right-hand side, finding a profile, you know, it was like that was feminine enough, but still masculine. You'll notice the woman has her arms crossed. We purposely worked on sort of a woman that could be every woman. And the other part that the publisher added that I thought was really nice was voices of bold leaders. So we had talked about embracing ambition, but just acknowledging that this was bold. And it's funny to be on the backside because you spend hours on these words, these adjectives. I did a market survey for the title. So I sent it out to the women, and then I sent it out to friends and people I thought might want to buy the book. And I had a bunch of different potential titles. And it was so helpful, just note to self. Like, you know, we do feasibility studies and fundraising to find out if something will fly. We do marketing studies. Like, don't put out a book without testing the title. And one of the ones I had was Overcoming. That was one of the titles I had. It was like Overcoming. And the whole crux I wanted was, it's not about the challenges. It's about what you do with the challenges when they're presented. That's really the theme of the book. And somebody said to me, Overcoming, oh, Jenny, you're no Michelle Obama, like too close to becoming. I was like, okay, you're right, you know? But people very much resonated with ambition. It's a bit of a loaded word for women. And some of my younger folks were like, they wanted the book to be called Ambition. They wanted to remove the word embracing. And when we kind of workshopped it, we felt that embracing ambition was this nice combo of like, embracing is a beguiling, is a feminine, is a warm, but still owning the ambition part. And on the same note, the subtext, the empowering women to step out, be seen and lead, that had like 25 iterations, no joke, swim. We went all over on that.
I believe it.
Yeah. To get it right.
I really do. Shoot. 12 amazing women giving their insights in the book. And you talked before the break a lot about collaboration. You use that word probably about 4, 5, 6 times.
Yeah.
A question, as women are in the nonprofit space or not in the nonprofit space, they're just, you know, living life. What can senior women leaders do to encourage and support emerging women leaders in the workforce, period?
I love that question. You know, the old paradigm is mentorship, right? The old paradigm, and I always joke that there's sort of three things. So mentorship is, this is how I did it. Consulting is, this is how you do it. Mm-hmm. And coaching is, how would you like to do it?
Mm-hmm.
So there's that slight nuance. And so I think we're more familiar with mentorship. This is how I did it. And I think there's a place for that. But I also think there's a place for that coaching. You know, how do you think that meeting went as a senior manager talking to a junior, opening up a dialogue? How did you think that meeting went? What was the best part about that meeting? What do you think you could have done better in the pursuit of coaching, in the pursuit of feed forward? And I think opening up, sometimes those conversations down the hall on the way out of the meeting can be incredibly learning moments.
Yes.
And so really kind of as a leader wanting to do that and support your direct reports. The second thing is the other word we're learning is sponsorship. So more than mentorship, actually stepping up and saying, I will be your sponsor in this corporate world. It's a term that's used in inclusion and diversity as well, Swim. So, you know, if we want to have more diverse leaders, different skin colors, different backgrounds, you know, different sexual orientations, some of us that are in positions of power are going to have to step up and say, I'm going to work with you. I'm going to sponsor you inside this organization so you don't get lost. Because there is a little bit of, in the corporate world, of a game to be played. And you got to learn how to play the game, right?
I always say nonprofit space people, especially if they're not in it, they may not realize that the nonprofit space is very similar to others. There's money, influence, and power. So yes, absolutely. There is games to be played sometimes.
Yeah. And like on a fundamental level, let's just use some analogies. You know, if you promote someone into, I'm just using a university, they're going to become a director of development in the faculty of law. Okay. And they're going to wear flip-flops and Birkenstocks to work every day and, you know, choose not to do their hair and not wear any makeup and wear very casual clothes. You know, they're not going to thrive. And the reason they're not going to thrive is not because we don't want individuals, is because we are working towards a common goal and we have to work within the constructs that we have. It's faculty of law. It's one of the most traditional departments. You're going to have to look the part. You don't have to give up your soul, to be clear, Swim. But you need to play enough of the game to get your needs met. That's what I always tell the people. I'm not here to tell you how to act. I'm here to be the most authentic version of you that works for that situation. But that's hard feedback to provide. So maybe the other part is, as women leaders, is to be brave enough to provide the feed forward that will fuel the next generation, rather than sitting back and saying, oh, I won't say that. that might hurt their feelings. So kindness versus being nice. Being nice is glossing over and ignoring the elephant in the room. Kindness is, I'm going to share this feedback with you because I believe you have incredible potential and I want to be part of that solution with you. You have all the makings you need. That being said, blah, 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 blah is holding you back. And I'd like to help you work on that together if you're willing.
Yeah. I'm going to look up more about sponsorship. That's a title or a phrase or an idea, I guess I should really say, that I'm not quite as familiar with. So definitely have some research to do in my space. Yeah. But it's funny because I've been in a nonprofit space now for about 20 years in one degree or another, starting all the way back when I was in high school, too, actually, being back in earlier parts of my education. I was a part of a junior Civitan and junior Rotary Club, where we would go out and do river cleanups in North Carolina. We'd, you know, food banks, you know, stuff that teenagers typically can do. And so being in the nonprofit space, surrounded by a lot of great, inspiring women, and I'm always curious to get some insights, because I think there are sometimes a little bit of like Mars or Venus or us versus them that can feel like it underlines the society of it's men versus women.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know, from your many years of experience in this space, what advice do you have for men leaders who would like to be champions of women in leadership roles?
Yep. Yeah. Thank you for the question. I have met the men leaders that I admire the most are the ones that are willing to do the work, the ones that are willing to be self-aware, the ones that are willing to question their actions, the ones that work with coaches, the ones that ask for feedback from their female leaders, the ones that make space at their leadership table. I don't think any woman wants to get somewhere because she's female. I think they want to get there because they're good at their jobs. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there is a blind spot, right? And let's talk about fundraising. Like if you want to go there, as a woman CEO, it is a lot harder to go to the men's club, country club, and play golf with all the CEOs of the large companies and fit in, right? And you are often probably working through a partner or a VP or a guy. It's just the way it's done. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm saying if you want to be successful and close that money for your mission, you do what needs to happen. But a lot of the men don't realize that is a barrier. So I'm calling it out right here on Swim's podcast. Notice, take note of that stuff, right? Because just because you don't think it exists doesn't mean it doesn't.
Sponsors can help with that too, right?
That's right. That's right.
Executive coaches can help. It's funny because I was in a role, interim role, where I was leading five different women for about 6 months. Maybe 9 months, something like that. I was leading a group of amazing women two times over, actually. It was like 6 months one time, 9 months another time. And I remember a story that really was really a good about face. And one of my first times leading a group of individuals, the person that I was seeing said, "Hey, I had one of the team members that's reporting to you reach out to me." That's always scary.
It sure is.
Always scary. And she said that the person that reached out to you was explaining a problem that they were having. And you tried to offer them nothing but solutions and advice. And she said, in certain moments, that's appropriate. You already know where this is going. She said, in certain moments, that's appropriate. But she said, sometimes people just want to be able to express themselves and vent. And she was doing back channel. She was basically saying that person wasn't looking for you to solve their problem. Mm-hmm. They were looking for you to understand their problem so that if maybe down the road that kind of came back up. But I was jumping, typical guy, right? Oh, have you tried this? Have you tried that? give this a whirl. But I had an amazing person that was leading me, who was giving me some really good insights into being a better leader and understanding the people around me. So I know sometimes guys, we go straight to, oh my gosh, how can we fix it? And women aren't necessarily looking for you to fix it all. Sometimes you just got to chill and give space and let people be themselves to grow.
Well, there's two awarenesses there. One is that you are open to the feedback, right? So if you talk about how can men, you know, taking genuinely listening to the feedback. And the second part of that is how don't we all want to be in healthy organizations where people can bring those? Do you know how often it's not like that in these organizations? There's a lot of, you know, we talk about the whistleblowers and all that. You know, when you can create a space of trust where those dialogues are open, to me, it's a continuum, right? It's a masculine feminine style continuum, and it ebbs and flows. Look, one of the things I work on the most, like on the flip side of that with women, is we cannot collaborate our way to a decision all the time. So women will tend to, you know, well, how is so-and-so feeling? How is so-and-so feeling? And, you know, we go through this whole rigmarole. It's like, just for God's sake, just please make a decision and stick with it. Because that is also a vice that you can get with collaboration. And so my point isn't my real message here is there's not a better or a worse. It really is a continuum. But when you know how you're fitting in, when you have that self-awareness, I do a lot of Enneagram assessments to help people understand their natural tendencies. Like I am a seven, for those of you, it's an enthusiastic visionary. So I have an idea in minute swim. Okay. I can come up with 10 million solutions to your problem. The downside is I really don't like planning. I really don't like articulating, putting things on paper. So if we take away the male, masculine, feminine, and we talk about it as far as personality types, our shops are so much more valuable when everybody contributes. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the point of having three people out of the eight senior leadership team make all the decisions? Like, how does that serve the mission? And I think it's just a big loss to the sector when we don't hear from those other voices.
Comes with experience.
Maturity.
Maturity. You're an executive coach. And you've worked with some impressive clients and organizations. I mean, we're talking Queen's University, Oxfam, YMCA, Children's Aid Foundation of Ottawa. I mean, a slew of top level individuals. And I can imagine a large percentage of our audience are thinking to themselves, I would benefit from a mentor, a sponsor, or an executive coach. Yeah. But if you've never had an executive coach, you might not be sure if it's for you. For people that are listening that have never had a dedicated mentor in their life or an executive coach, it could seem like a foreign concept. So for people in the nonprofit space, particularly women that may be listening to this particular podcast, interested in hiring a coach, what are the things that people should be looking for if they're looking for an executive coach?
So I'm going to start with the person. What's your goal? What is the deficiency or the challenge that you're experiencing? And who can you get to help you solve it? So there's a whole level of self-awareness there. You know, believe it or not, when you leave a job, the challenges you had at that job actually follow you swim across the street, right? You think you're leaving the problem, but it comes with you because we are humans and we have habits. Absolutely. So you don't know what you don't know. So you hit that point where you're like, okay, I'm ready to make a change. I'm feeling brave because I want to honor the bravery of saying something's not working. It's a pretty brave thing to say. So, and have some kind of a specificity. It doesn't be perfectly, but I often find when clients come to me with a goal, like I'd like to address I'd like to be a better leader, a mentor, better manager to the people. People seem to not like working with me, or I feel like I'm misunderstood at my organization. A lot of them come to me and say, I want to work on my executive presence. I want to be seen as leadership material, right? Mm-hmm. And to which I always ask, I always find that one funny because I'm like, so tell me what executive presence looks like. And they're like, I don't know. And I'm like, exactly, because it's very specific to each person. And so you actually have to do the work to figure out what that means to you. And then all of a sudden people notice. The work of coaching is internal and then it's reflected external. So you want a coach that first of all, you can feel comfortable with. I think that's actually first off, most important.
Absolutely.
Someone who you feel you can trust.
You're being vulnerable here.
Very vulnerable, that you can be honest with, I actually think you do not need expertise in the sector. So let me explain that. You know, I work a lot with fundraisers because that's my background, but I can coach just about anyone. And the reason is we're talking about context, not content. So the risk, our job as a coach is to create a space. I could talk about this for hours because I love this. A space for people to reflect, a place to be a cheerleader. My role as a coach is to be a cheerleader, a challenger, a question asker, a perspective offering. I am not in charge. The coachee is in charge. And it's very important that that dynamic is set up. People don't come to me to be fixed, right? People come to me to grow in the way that they want to grow, in the way that they want to thrive. And so my job is to ask hopefully good questions to help them get clarity on that and to own it and to move forward on their own. Their success is not my success. I cheer them on, absolutely, but I want them to walk away knowing they did that.
One more time. I'm going to get this very close here. I got to zoom in. I got all types of angles here. One more time. Embracing ambition, empowering women to step out, be seen, and lead. Jenny, I want to give you the space to share how people can connect with you, work with you, all of that jazz. But at the baseline, at its core, has some good insights. At its core, what do you hope readers will embrace after reading this book, after reading your book?
My hope with this book is that people realize or reconnect with the fact that they have something to contribute. And by reading these pillars and by reading these stories, they'll have the courage to dust themselves off, get back on the horse, and get back on the ring, in the ring. That's my hope. The book is available on Amazon, just heads up. So you can just go to Amazon and put in Embracing Ambition and you'll find me. I'm available, always happy to talk to people in whatever that looks like for you in your world, at chavender.com, which is chavender like lavender, but with a CH at the beginning. Also a fish. Did I tell you that, Swim? It's a fish. The chavender is a fish.
We're Pisces.
Pisces, right?
Yeah. Nickname is Swim.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was thinking, right? Exactly. And so this fish lives on the east coast of North America and up near Halifax, and it survives harsh winters. It can live in murky waters. It's been around for centuries. It's very adaptable. And so you know where this is going, right? What a great analogy for the not-for-profit world.
All right. People, we know how people can find you. I can't let you get out of here without doing one of our things. Because one of the things we like to do here in the Nonprofit Insider Podcast, we like to end each episode with a nonprofit horror story as a way to show some of the more realistic aspects of being in the nonprofit space. And that's what I like to do here in the podcast, is sharing horror stories. Not horrific, we already know, but understanding different aspects of being in a nonprofit space. Understand you might have a story.
Always have a story.
You have a story for us.
Yeah. Well, actually, the one that comes to mind was one of the very first galas I put on. And I was working as a volunteer with a colleague who is the staff member. It was in New York City. It was a very expensive venue. We're talking 15, 20 years ago. And the gala got pulled together at the very last minute on shoestrings. You know how that is, Swim? Where you pull it out of your butt.
I had previous episodes about the nonprofit space. What's it going to look like with events? It kind of ebbs and flows with the economy, but yes.
Yeah, it was the proverbial show. So, but we got through it. Okay. We got through it. I was in charge of the auction. You know, we raised, I think it was somewhere around 22,000, and the next morning I wake up and I realize that we've left all the credit card slips with all the donors who bought auction items, credit card information at the venue overnight.
Uh-oh.
Not good. For so many reasons. Now, it does have a wonderful ending because we were able to go and collect them and no harm was done. But can you imagine the number of the risks there of somebody at the venue taking them home? I mean, it could have been really, really bad.
I mean, honestly, as a fundraiser, that's a nightmare.
It's a nightmare.
That's an absolute sweating all night. I mean, you're probably there the next morning as soon as they open. You're like sleeping outside, like, I got to get back in. Wow. I'm glad that everything worked out, but wow.
Yeah, that's why I hate
events. Sticks with you all the way to this day.
I hate events. Yeah, it sticks with me to this day. It was probably unfortunately with these horror stories, you learn, right? You do learn. It's a tough way to learn. You know, there's a lot of, that could have been so bad, Swim. I've made you speechless. This is impressive.
Well, we got to get more fundraisers. I know you got an amazing network. I'm going to have to stay in touch with you. The book is Embracing Ambition, Empowering Women to Step Out, Be Seen, and Lead. That was a great nonprofit horror story that has a very good ending. We like when our horror stories end on a really good note. One more time, Jenny, this is honestly such a blast. Listen, keeping up with some of the things that you've been doing and listening to your podcast, obviously you're impressive. You're a go-getter and you really define the aspect of ambition, going out there, pushing yourself, collaborating, leading, making decision makings. You really are what so many people are really trying to become when they grow. That's what I was gonna say. When I grow up, I need to be like you, basically. I got to be like you.
And never lose your heart, Swim, right? It's got to always start with heart and caring and compassion.
Absolutely. Listen, all the information is in the show notes. Jenny, we appreciate it. We'll be seeing you around. We cannot wait for people to listen to this episode.
Thanks very much, Swim.
Take care.